found by calculating was we got a term which was dc dc squared, which was suppressed by 1 over, let me write that, we had lambda over 4 mr squared d mu c squared. This is what you'd call a dimension 8 operator, because if you count the dimensions of the fields and the derivatives, this is energy to the 8th, and that's why the coefficient was 1 over m to the 4th. I got that wrong again. But you might have thought, well, why didn't we write anything down here with 1 over m squared? Why don't we have a dimension 6 operator, which is larger than that one? Maybe our calculation didn't produce it, but maybe it's really there and it arises maybe at second order in lambda or something, and we didn't see it in, at tree level, but it's really there. So let's go through this exercise of asking what could possibly arise here suppressed only by 2 powers of mr. So the question is, what could we possibly write here? So the rule is, we're supposed to take things that are functions of c and derivatives, and we want something which has a total of 6 of them, because we want something which has got dimension of energy to the 6th, and we want it to be suppressed by 1 over a mass squared to get energy to the 4th as our Lagrangian. So what can we do? One thing we could do is write down something like d mu, which is some coefficient c1, and let me use the same notation as in these notes. Actually, c2 is what I was going to call it. D mu, d nu, c, d mu, d nu, c. Where c2, I'll actually explicitly write the mr squared here. So if I write the mr squared explicitly, this will be something which is dimensionless. But this thing had to be a 1 over energy squared to get the dimensions right. I could also contract the derivatives differently. So that was what I was going to call c1. We have d mu c box d mu c, where box is just d mu, d lambda, d lambda. You can imagine I could have, I can't have c by itself, I cannot have all the derivatives acting on c and nothing on without c, because that would be something which I'm only trying to write things down that are functions of derivatives. You could say, well, maybe, why don't I allow myself 3 xc's? I could have d xc, d xc, d xc. Problem there is that I can't make anything Lorentz invariant, because there's no way to contract something with 3 indices to get a Lorentz invariant combination. So I can't write anything involving 3 xc's. So then these are the things that have 2 xc's. I could have 1 xc, I guess. That's something else I could write down. So I could have box xc. Actually, I can't have 1 xc. So this is dimension 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I need another derivative, but now I have nothing to contract that last the index on the last derivative to make something Lorentz invariant. So I can't write down something with only 1 xc. And there's another reason why I wouldn't want to write that down either. So if there's something which involves 2 powers of mr in the denominator, it has to be one of those 2 things. And I now want to make an argument as to why these things are allowed in the effective Lagrangian, but they're what's called redundant. So I want to claim that, so we could keep them, and then when we go off in this program of calculating observables, we would find that no observables depend on C1 or C2. And so it's a waste of time to keep them. And so any operator that's like that is what's called redundant. And so there's two ways, the main ways in which you can find that interactions are redundant. One of them is, if this thing is a total derivative, then what will happen is that when we integrate the Lagrangian to get the action, we can integrate the integral of a total derivative is a boundary term, and so that's something which can only affect boundaries. And so it can appear in observables, but it has to be observables that care what's going on at the boundaries, which is usually not the case. That there are exceptions to that, but it's often not the case. In perturbation theory in particular, they're not contributing anything. And the second thing is, if I can remove an interaction like this by doing a field redefinition of xi, then it also means that can't appear in anything physical, because nature doesn't care what fields we choose to describe it with. Nature is nature. So in practice, that's going to mean that if I take anything here which vanishes when I use the equations of motion for the first term, that's something which I can remove with the field redefinition, is what I want to show you. So those are the 2 things I want to two categories of redundant operators I want to go through, because the idea is that when you're making a list of these operators, you're always allowed to simplify your options by getting rid of total derivatives if you're not caring about surface terms, and doing field redefinitions to remove interactions that are any interactions that you can change, whose coefficient you can change with a field redefinition is something which is not in anything physical, so you don't need to track that particular coefficient. You might as well do the field redefinition where its coefficient is zero. No, I mean like in this particular case, I'm going to get rid of one by taking C goes to C plus box C. So it could be a nonlinear redefinition, but it's some reparameterization of the variables you're using, but not simply rescaling. Yeah.
Sorry, you might have explained this. Are there not more terms that we could add in that? Like, can you not have, for example, box, diamond C, diamond C?
And what's the box acting on this?
Oh.
Or both of them, like that?
Yeah.
Actually, no, you can. Let's add that one. This is going to be, I probably threw it away because of an argument I'm about to give. But it's true that's, from what I've told you so far, that would look perfectly good. Yeah. Okay. So let's get rid of this one first. So the first claim is that any interaction of the form is d mu v mu only contributes to observables through the boundary values of any fields, or of the fields. And so things like we've been calculating the scattering processes, we're always working within a configuration where the fields are falling off to zero at infinity. And so the things we've been looking at so far would not care about boundary values, and so would not care about the value of C3. I'll show you explicitly why that's true in a second, but that's because the action here, so delta action would be the integral d4x of delta L, and then if I use Stokes' theorem, that's the integral of d3x normal vector of v mu. And so if I do this in the path integral, this explicitly only cares about the, I'm imagining here that v is some function of c, let's say, whatever the fields are. So this would be the particular combination of fields and the derivatives that this particular interaction cares about. So for example, if we had been doing a, oh good, I can see you guys now on the big screen.
Yay.
Although I'm getting a bit of my voice back here, so. All right, so. Let me see if I can get rid of the. I'm going to hit the mute button on the laptop, and I'm not sure if you're hearing me already from my throat mic here. So let me just see what happens if I turn this off. Can you hear us? Can you still hear us?
No.
Okay, you can't hear us. Okay, good.
No.
Okay, let me just see if I can turn the volume down a little bit on our end. All right, test, 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 test,
yeah.
Test.
We're good here.
Yeah, the problem is I hear you guys fine, but I also hear me fine. So every time I say something, I hear kind of a bark from the microphone or from the speaker. Okay, all right. So let's imagine that we had something like this interaction, and let's calculate the Feynman rule. I just want to show you explicitly that, so the instruction here is that anything that's a total derivative is irrelevant to observables that don't depend on boundary conditions in any great detail, And in particular, the calculations we've been doing are in that class of observables is what I want to show you now. And so the way I want to do that is let's just calculate the Feynman rules for this interaction and see what it looks like. And you'll see why it doesn't do anything. So the Feynman rule in this case for box of... Well, let's just do it. So if I write this out, this is d lambda d mu c d mu c. Right, that's the thing we're talking about. All right, C3. So I just want to do these derivatives here. So it's C3 d lambda d lambda d mu c d mu c plus d mu c. Actually, what's going to happen is we're going to get to factor 2 from doing the other derivative. So sounds like there's a crime going on at your end there. Okay. So this is a Feynman rule corresponding to something like this. Two external fields. Let's say there's momentum coming in P, and let's take the other momentum coming in to be Q, and I'll choose them both to point inward. So this will be something, and then momentum conservation at this vertex will be give me a factor of I 2 pi to the fourth, which is just normalization, but it'll give me a delta function, which is delta of P plus Q. It's saying that the total momentum flowing in of this vertex is zero. And I want to know now what's the coefficient of this thing. And the coefficient of this thing will be, there'll be a 2C3 from this factor up front. And then we're going to get a bunch of momenta from these fields, because the fields, you remember, are Fourier, they're sums over momenta of creation dilation operators. And these derivatives are pulling down the momenta that are in the Fourier transforms in the field. So we have something like C is, integral dp of a p e to the I px plus stuff, and so when we do d mu c, we're getting integral dp of I p mu a sub p e to the I px, just because all the x dependence is always in some sort of a phase like that. So the Feynman rule is always going to pull down a momentum for every derivative, or I times a momentum for every derivative, and which momentum it is, P or Q, depends on which field we're talking about. So if this is the field for whom the momentum is P, then we'll get a P, and if this is the one for which we get a Q, then we'll get a Q. So this is what we have to do here. So the coefficient is going to be, let's do these guys first. These guys, let's say this is the guy who carries momentum P, and this is the one that carries momentum Q. So we'll get a factor of P lambda, I times P lambda, I times P mu, and then we'll get an I times Q mu from these derivatives. And then this guy is going to get, it's going to be two terms. This one will hit, this derivative will hit this field, and then there'll be a place where it hits this field. And so we're going to get a sum of two terms. In the first term, we'll get an IP, and the second time, we'll get an IQ. That's a lambda. Right? And so the thing I want you to see is these factors are not so important, but the important thing is this one. Because we essentially got a delta function which says that this has to vanish, and then we got a factor of that, which makes it vanish. So if we'd actually done the Feynman rule with this interaction and we just turned the crank with it, we would have been finding that it's never appearing anywhere because the momentum conservation at the delta at the vertex is making the amplitude that you get from this Feynman rule vanish. And what did it to you was this last derivative that was a total derivative of everybody. Because it differentiates every field in the problem once, and you end up getting a sum of all the momenta for all the fields in your problem once, and that's exactly the thing that's being put into your momentum-conserving delta function. So at the Feynman graph level, the reason you don't keep these things is that they just don't appear anywhere. But at a deeper level, you can kind of see the reason they're not appearing anywhere is because their contribution to the action is a surface term, and so all that we'll care about is the things that are on the surfaces, and typically that's something which is fixed as you do other things, like you choose different observables. So it's important to know that it's there, because some things do care about boundary conditions, but it's not something which is distinguishing, going to make a difference when we calculate effective interactions the way we have been doing it.
So does that mean that the primary rules are invalid if you have boundary contributions?
No, this is a the story there is that the you know in writing these wave functions, we're really using the boundary conditions, and there's a statement normally that if you're in infinite space that you're looking at fields which are when you say that operators are Hermitian and things like that, you're saying the fields are falling off in a particular way or they're oscillatory, say, at infinity. And so normally we make that statement once and for all, and that was implicit in the derivation of the Feynman rules in the first place in momentum space. And so then if we never change that boundary condition, then nothing ever depends on it. So the Feynman rules kind of have that boundary condition built in, and so and they're giving us zero. So if we calculate, it doesn't matter what process we calculate, we're always going to get zero because the boundary conditions we had chosen are giving us zero here. And so that's never going to change no matter what we look at.
But if you did have different boundary conditions, you would get a different
Feynman rule? Yeah, in principle. So if you had a boundary, let's say, in like a Casimir effect or something, and you actually wanted to know what the boundary was doing, then that physics that knows about the boundary will care about this term, and then it'll actually make a difference in the calculations, the effective interactions you get. In that case, in our Lagrangian, we should have also had a boundary component to the Lagrangian. We would have written the Lagrangian as integral over the volume of something, but then we should have added to it an integral over the surface of the boundary, another Lagrangian. And that's capturing the boundary physics. One of the later topics is about that, so I'll say more about that. Second thing, so that kind of allows you to kill this one. It also shows you that these are not independent of one another, right? Because for this one, if I integrate by parts, I can write this derivative, I can write it as a total derivative, which I've just argued you don't have to keep, minus a term where the derivative is on this side, but then d mu with d mu is box, and so then it becomes this one. So if I'm allowed to drop total derivatives, I can combine those two terms. And so I would in that case, I'd have delta L is minus c2 minus c1 over mr squared, d mu c box d mu c. That's the only thing we could imagine happening at dimension 6. So I'll write this as a sub 6. So this means the thing going like 1 over mr squared. So what's wrong with these? So the quick and dirty sign that there's something, that this is not going to play any role in observables is that the equation of motion, the big term in the Lagrangian is this one. So the equation of motion for the unperturbed Lagrangian is just if I vary C, I get box C equals zero. So this interaction has the property that when I evaluate it at the solution of these equations of motion, it vanishes. So now, you might think, well, so why do I care? Because this is something I'm sticking inside a path integral somewhere, right? So I'm not actually looking, I'm evaluating the Lagrangian at field configurations that are not satisfying the equations of motion. So the claim is not that because we're interested in classical things, that this is vanishing because I'm using the classical equations of motion. The argument for why this is, why it's important to notice when this is true is that whenever this is true, that something vanishes when you use the lower order of equations of motion, lower order in the expansion of 1 over m. Whenever that happens, you're guaranteed that there's a field redefinition that removes this term. So in this particular case, imagine I take the field redefinition c goes to c plus some number, let's call it b over mr squared box c. If I do that change of variables in this Lagrangian, in this term what happens is I get, so L naught goes to L naught. And then the variation, I'll get a factor of minus B over MR squared D mu C box D mu C. And then I'll get a term quadratic in this when I vary them both. But if I'm only interested in things that order 1 over MR squared, that's something which I can neglect. So this is something order 1 over R to the fourth. So you can see and now if I do that change of variables here, what will happen is that I started off with a 1 over mr squared. I'm going to get another mr squared from the change of variables. And so I'll end up with something which is also order 1 over mr to the fourth. So at the order I'm working, the only change to this Lagrangian is to add this term to what we had before. But this is the same term as we're talking about here. Sorry, I pointed to this one, but I meant to point to this one. And so that means that after this change of variables, what's happened is that this coefficient C1 has now become C1 plus B. So if I choose B to be minus C1 here, then I can make that coefficient 0. And that means that by doing a field redefinition, I've removed that coefficient from the Lagrangian. And so that means that since observables don't care about field redefinitions, they won't, the value, if I had done the calculation keeping this observable, what I'd find is that it just, the C1 never appears in any of the answers. So I'll never learn what the value of C1 is by comparing observables computed with this theory with the full theory, but I'll also never care what its value is because it never appears anywhere. So B equals minus C1 eliminates the DC box DC term to order 1 over m r squared.
Is
what always true?
When you have a term that involves the equations of motion,
yeah.
When you do
the root, yeah. And the reason, and so let me show you why. So it's the question, if you didn't hear it at home, was that is it always true, or is this just an accident for this one example? And so so I want to argue why it's generally true that if I give you an action, which is a zeroth order thing as a function of some field, plus some small parameter times a first order thing, and so on. And supposing I said that the S1 has a piece in it which vanishes when I use the first equation of motion. So let's say it has the form something times the integral d4x of the derivative of S0 delta x, delta phi of x. And let's say the coefficient could have depended on x for all I know, so it's C of x. So anything of that form that's proportional to, that vanishes when the equations of motion are satisfied. So what I'll do is I have to do it, I have to give you the change of variable. So what I'll do is I'll say, let's take delta phi to be minus epsilon times C of x, period. So now I go through the same argument. So I vary this thing. I do this variation. So phi. So what I mean here is that phi is going to phi minus epsilon C of x. So under this change of variables, this term doesn't change because the change is order epsilon, and this is already order epsilon. So that's something which is order epsilon squared. This thing will change. So S naught will go to itself plus this thing, but the variation of S0 is going to be the derivative of S0 times the variation. And so S0 goes to S0 of phi minus the integral d4x of epsilon C of x delta S0 delta phi of x. And so if I choose so I had plus epsilon C. So you see that now what happens if I stick this into here, then this term will cancel this term because of it's equal to that. And I'm just left with S0. And supposing we had went further down the series here, this is normally it's enough to do it at first order, but you could be further down the series, and the lesson is that you can always use the lower order equations to simplify the last. If you're at the epsilon n level, if we'd done this to order epsilon to the n, and the epsilon to the n plus 1 term had a piece which vanishes with variations of actions, the story would be that the epsilon to the n plus 1 thing, I can simplify it with this equation of motion or the second first order equation of motion or the second order equation of motion. And you can kind of do this argument I'm giving you, you can do it by induction for further down the series. But essentially this is the argument that there's a simple field redefinition you can do which removes these things that are vanishing when you use the equation of motion. So if someone hands you a bunch of Lagrangians, which is what way that actually the problem actually comes up, it's easy to tell which ones you can get rid of because you just say, well, the equation of motion here where box psi equals 0, I should never have anything that has a box psi in it. Okay, so.
Yeah.
The noise? Okay. Did you guys hear that suggestion?
Yeah.
So the suggestion is, if you mute your side of Skype so we can't hear you until you want to ask a question, then what's happening now is that when I speak, it's being picked up and it's being rebroadcast back to us. But if you mute your side, then we won't hear it. But when you want to say something, turn the mute off. Is that okay?
Yeah, we're trying that now.
Test. Okay, that works fine here. So if it's a problem, you know, I don't want to discourage questions from your end. So if you find that you're, you know, getting over to the mute button is a problem, let us know. But so far, this is working better here. Okay. Right. So the bottom line is, two reasons that things are redundant, and that these are the normal reasons, are total derivatives can usually be pitched, and things that are vanishing with equations of motion of the lower order Lagrangian can be pitched because they can be removed with the field redefinition. So right away, you know, we have a theorem, right, that we calculated when we integrated out the heavy guy in the toy model, that we were getting an effective interaction which was proportional to 1 over m to the fourth power, and you might have worried, well, we didn't get one, we got no contributions that went like 1 over m squared, but in principle they could have been there, and maybe that was an artifact of the calculation we did. Here you can see that there's no approximation there, here we're just writing down the most general thing we can write down involving this field and this symmetry and stopping at order 1 over mr squared, and the conclusion is there's nothing we can write down which can contribute to observables. So the prediction is that we will never find any observables which get contributions that are only suppressed by 2 powers of mr. The very minimal suppression is by 4 powers of mr, and you know, we identified one of the things that could have been, and we can go through the exercise of classifying all the possible interactions at dimension 8 which have a 1 over mr to the fourth in front of them, which I think the notes actually do, but I don't know if I'll do that right now. Okay. So the bottom line is that now we have our Lagrangian. So now let's suppose that we've got our Lagrangian. And then the next question is, we're not done yet knowing what the Lagrangian. The good thing about the Lagrangian was more derivatives, more fields cost more powers of 1 over m, and those are expensive if we're at low energies. So there's not a lot of them if we're going to have only a few powers of 1 over m. So let's say we're interested in physics to order 1 over mr to the 8th, say. Now the next question, so that tells us that when we're writing the Lagrangian down where to stop. We want to keep terms only up to terms of dimension 12 that have a 1 over mr to the 8th in front of them. But the next part of the question will be, given that Lagrangian involving all those interactions ordered to 1 over mr to the 8th, what, in a Feynman rule expansion of the path integral, which terms are contributing to observables that order 1 over mr to the 8th? They're not all going to contribute, because if I have, you know, a graph with a whole bunch of vertices coming from the 1 over mr to the 8th term, I have more than one of them, it's probably going to contribute at higher order than 1 over mr to the 8th. So we want an efficient way of knowing, before we start, which graphs do we do to which order to get everything but not, that contributes to some fixed order in 1 over m. And so that's what the next topic is. So that's called power counting. So the question is, given a Lagrangian as an expansion in powers of 1 over m squared, which graphs contribute to observables to any fixed order in 1 over m squared? So again, I want to, let's do this in an example. But here I want to use an example that's more general than the one we've been using, the toy model, because the toy model doesn't have a lot of scales in it. So let me imagine writing down a Wilson Lagrangian, which is good. So all possible kinds of interactions and derivatives and powers of fields. But I'm going to write a slightly broader class, which will include the toy model, but it's broader than the toy model, and it includes other interesting examples that we're going to talk about later on. So let's... So let's suppose we have a Lagrangian, which is, and let me now write it the way I wanted to write it. And here I'm switching notes. Actually, maybe I should, I think I can do one more thing before I change the notes on you. Let's just. So what I'd like to do is I would like to, and this is going to sound bizarre, but I'm going to bear with me for a second. I'm going to suppose that the Lagrangian has an overall scale in front of it. So I'm going to imagine that I'm going to have several scales. I'm going to have several dimensional parameters that are all kind of, think of them as being roughly the same size. But we're also going to look at examples where they're different in size later on. So I've got a scale F, a scale capital M, and a scale V. And roughly speaking, what I want you to think about is the overall size of the Lagrangian is going to be set by f to the fourth. The size of derivatives are going to be compared to m, and the size of the value of the field will be compared to v. And up until now, we've been imagining that there's only one scale in the problem, and I'm going to just slightly generalize it so we have several scales. So I'm going to imagine that the Lagrangian is f to the fourth times some function, call it l hat, which is a function of the fields. I'll call it c again, maybe. Let me call it phi, divided by v. And derivatives of the fields, which I'll divide by mv. So every time I have a field, I'll divide it by v to get a dimensionless thing, because this has dimensions of energy. And everywhere I have a derivative, I'm going to divide it by m to get a dimensionless thing. And then so that gives me some dimensionless function. To get the right dimensions, I'm multiplying it by little f to the fourth power to get something that dimensions energy to the fourth power. And so our previous example is in this category where all these things are the same mr, but this is kind of a useful class of things to think about. So in particular, if we'd written this thing as f to the fourth, if we'd written it as being a free thing, you know, d mu phi, I'm supposed to divide that by m squared v squared. And if I had a mass term, this is a capital M I'm drawing here. So let me write a mass term as a mu, maybe mu squared phi squared. I should be dividing that by v squared. And I guess the question will be now, what do I use for mu there? So now my options are, mu is either going to have dimensions of mass, which is what I wanted to think of if I'd written a Lagrangian with a kinetic term and a mass term. Let's imagine that's a mass. I'm going to treat the mass like it's a momentum, because the energy squared will be the momentum squared plus the mass squared. And so if I'm comparing energies and derivatives to capital M, I'm going to normalize all my mass in the same way. So these have the same factor of m squared v squared. And then if I had interaction terms, I could have things like, what's an example? So we could have things like d mu phi squared with some coefficient c1. And this would come in this set of rules with 4 powers of m and 4 powers of v. I'm not assuming here I have a shift symmetry where the field is invariant as I shift things, so I could imagine writing down something like phi to the eighth with some other coefficient c2, and that would come with a v to the eighth, and just all possible combinations you could do, and they're all going to come with a specific power of m and v in them with some dimensionless coefficients. So these c's, the way I've defined them, are dimensionless. So the program is, we want to take this Lagrangian, So this is going to be the unperturbed part. And we want to calculate the how these parameters f, m, and v appear in Feynman rules for some arbitrary graph with arbitrary numbers of vertices from all these various interactions and whose internal lines are describing the inverse of this operator, because that's the propagator for this theory. And so all I'm going to do is I'm going to just track the f, m, and v's everywhere because they're explicit in the Lagrangian. And then we're going to get things involving integrals over the momenta of the particles, the internal lines of the graph. And we're going to have to choose what we do about those integrals, because those integrals, they're in general, they're complicated. They'll depend on external momenta and things like that. But the I'm interested in the order of magnitude of the answer as a function of light energies divided by these big scales f, m, and v. And so we're going to have to choose how we evaluate the graphs. And it's going to be at that point that you'll see that it's going to make a difference how we regulate the graphs, because these graphs are going to diverge. If we cut them off, then the dimensional arguments I'm going to make are going to be hard. And what they're going to do is they're going to tell you how these graphs diverge. And that's the way the argument I'm making is the usual argument you make when you're trying to decide when you're just showing that things are normalizable or how you absorb divergences. And what I'm going to be calculating for you is the superficial degree of divergence of a graph. But it's something which is not so useful if I'm interested in identifying how observables depend on a light energy scale divided by m or f or v. So then when we get to the point of doing these integrals, I'll redo them in dimensional regularization, where the dimensions of the answer are all coming from external momenta or actual physical parameters in your problem and not from how you regulated things. There's a scale in dimensional regularization, but it always comes in as a logarithm. And so what's nice about it is that it makes dimensional analysis very simple in this kind of argument I'm going to give you. And then you'll see that'll be where we have a clean statement about how observables depend on M. So that's where we're going. So let's start with so we're going to take this Lagrangian. We're going to imagine evaluating, you know, the integral, the path integral of e to the I action, possibly with a current times phi. And we want to do this path integral in a semi-classical approximation. And we're imagining calculating the Feynman rules with this unperturbed Lagrangian, this perturbed thing where I write everything here, all possible powers of phi, all possible derivatives. And so a generic term in this series here will be some coefficient and some operator, which is a function of powers of phi, as many factors of phi, and as many factors of derivatives. And I'm going to label this by the number of powers of phi that are in the operator and the number of derivatives in the operator. So let's say, I'm going to use the same labels I used here. So D and F. So D counts the number of derivatives, and F counts the number of fields. And so I'll call this as D and F. And really, there'll be more than one operator with a fixed number of derivatives and fields, so I should really imagine labeling them by other things too. But the important thing for what we're going to do is these the total number of D's and F's. So in this example here, we've got a total of, you know, D would be equal to 4, and we've got a total of F is equal to 4 here because there's 4 fields and 4 derivatives. Here we have D equals 0, F equals 8, and so on. You know, this would be D equals 2, F equals 2, D equals 0, F equals 2, and so on. So you know what, you get what I mean by D and F. The reason I'm doing that is that that tells me how many powers of M and V are. Or I'm going to have F powers of V. So let's make that explicit. I'll have a factor of M to the D and V to the F. And then, F, bad choice. Let me use K rather than F, because I don't want you to confuse it with this F.
Is there any reason, is it just like that because we don't have this, we don't require that the fields is only a function of derivatives, we could have like phi cubed terms.
Yep.
Okay, so we could.
Phi cubed, yeah, phi to the n here. So this is supposed to be representative of, but essentially anything you want. That, and the only thing is I'm going to focus on, normally you would not include things that are linear or quadratic in phi, although you could. Nothing I'm going to say is going to require that you don't do that. Well, I probably will require it at some point, but you'll see why in a second. And normally what the story there is that the linear things are the ones that you're dealing with in this whole path integral approach. The linear thing is all about the current that you're choosing, and then that's something which is systematically small. And it's really just getting rid of the one-particle reducible graphs. And things that are quadratic, are these things, but the normal statement is that if I had tried writing other things down, if I had two fields and I wrote a phi 1, phi 2 term, then you can always do a field redefinition that diagonalizes all those things. So the claim is I'm, by diagonalizing the quadratic terms, I'm not really making an assumption, but it is true that I'm choosing a specific set of fields when I write things this way. All right, so let's imagine some graph which has, imagine a graph which involves E external lines, I internal lines, let's say it has V sub DK vertices of this type with D derivatives and K powers of the field. So the Feynman rules will be, each vertex will be something which has a bunch of lines, I'll just draw solid lines, a bunch of lines that are all converging at that vertex. How many lines? Well, there will be K of them, right? There'll be one for each field that you had in that vertex. So we have a total of K external lines. They all meet, if I have a vertex with labeled by K, that's a vertex graphically for which K lines converge. That's what the K means. And then the D is telling you that some of these lines are differentiated, and so there's going to be, the Feynman rule for this will be I times 2 pi to the fourth times a delta function for the sum of all the momenta, P1 plus da-da-da-da, PK. And then there's some factor up front, and that factor will have D powers of the various momenta. So there'll be something like P to the D, where that means D a monomial involving D powers of various combinations of these P's. And when I'm only going to be doing these integrals in a dimensional way, so I don't really care if it's P1 squared or if it's P1 dot PK. It's just, I'll write it as P to the D for now. So the goal is now we want to evaluate what the amplitude is that we would get. So let's imagine we calculate a scattering matrix like we did the very first day with the toy model. Scattering amplitude. So imagine using this graph as part of a calculation of some scattering amplitude with E external lines and a bunch of momenta. So, Q, I'll say Q, P will be the momenta inside the graph, and Q will be the external momenta. So I'll have Q1 to QE. So there'll be something here. And so I'll have to take this graph, and it'll have, so what's it going to be proportional to? So I'll have a whole bunch of vertices in it. And each one will have some number of lines coming together at that point. And different vertices will have different numbers of lines. And I'll have a total of E external lines. And I'm supposed to connect them up in all possible ways and take the answer that I get. And for every internal line, I'm supposed to do an integral over the momentum in that line. And for every vertex, I'll have a delta function that is expressing momentum and energy conservation at that vertex. And so those delta functions will do some of the integrals. But once I'm done, there'll be an overall momentum conservation delta function that expresses that the total amount of momentum flowing in was conserved. But all the rest of the delta functions that are appearing in this graph are going to do some of the integrals that I'll get when I start connecting up these lines. And if I start drawing a graph now which connects everything up in all possible ways, say that's our graph. Each of these lines that's connecting to two different vertices has an integral d4p of it, of the momentum flowing along it. And so some of those things are also appearing in the delta functions. The momentum of every line appears in the delta functions at the end of the line. And so you can always use one of those delta functions to do the integral. And so there'll be some of the integrals that get done that way, but there'll be some that won't be done that way. And one question will be, how many are left? This is an example of a one-particle reducible graph, because I could cut this line and it breaks into two. And that's not going to make a difference what I'm doing, but if you don't like that, then draw another line. All right, so what's this amplitude look like? Where look like is I want to track the factors of F, M, and V. So the vertices will be easy, because, where did I put the Lagrangian? I need to leave this board visible, because, so I know that every vertex comes with a factor of 1 over m to the d and 1 over v to the k, and an overall factor of f squared, f to the fourth, right, because that's in front of everything. So this amplitude, I'll just write q for all the various external momenta. It's going to go like, I'll have a product over all the vertices. So over d, product over vertices, d and k, I guess. And we'll have 1 over m to the d, 1 over v to the k. And we'll have that for every vertex with that many derivatives and that many fields, of which we said we had v. And then we take the product over all possible d's and k's in our graph. So that we, you know, some of these vertices might have, this one had, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This one had 3. So that, you know, d's and k's, there's a variety of different vertices. So that's this factor. And I also had, sorry, the f to the fourth. I forgot that. So this is, I should have had an f to the fourth here for each one. Now, the external lines, the internal lines also have factors of f to the fourth and m squared and v squared in them, because I'm supposed to take this thing and I take 1 over it to get the propagator. So every factor of the propagator is going to have a factor of 1 over f to the fourth over m squared v squared. So I'll have a factor of m squared v squared over f to the fourth for every internal line. And that's the factors of m and v. And I'll have, for every vertex, for every internal line, I'll have an integral d4p divided by 2 pi to the fourth. There's actually a factor of minus I for every propagator, too. I might as well put that in. Then we'll have every vertex that had, the vertices all come with powers of, with p powers of momentum, p to the d, because that means there were d derivatives in every vertex. So we'll have a factor of essentially p to the d for every vertex. And then we'll have a propagator. The propagator part, the momentum part of the propagator would be p squared plus m squared. So we'll have a 1 over p squared plus mu squared. And we'll have that for every internal line, basically. And then we'll have momentum conservation at every vertex. We'll have an I times 2 pi to the fourth times delta to the four of p1 to pk. And you know, this is schematic, clearly, because what's really happening is that the momentum throwing through a particular line, the delta functions are going to start relating them to the external momenta. So there's the q, the dependence on the external momenta is buried in this, because for momentum conservation is saying that the energy, say, coming in here and here, or let's take a simple example. Oh, there are no simple examples here. So if I take the energies coming in here, the energy flowing out here, you know, was the sum of those two energies. And so the momentum conservation is going to feed q's into all these various terms. And so, and it's a multidimensional integral, and there's a long story there. You could worry that the integrals over this multidimensional space, I'm going to treat it as if it's a one-dimensional integral, that we're just basically counting dimensional analysis, powers of energy divided by these explicit scales that are here. And that, there's a theorem, Weinberg's theorem, which essentially says that's right, that you miss things like logarithms of ratios of things that are coming from corners where some momenta are large and some momenta are small. But for the purposes of just counting how things go grossly, how the powers of scales appear, I'm not lying to you. So what we want to do now is group these things in such a way that I guess the first thing we can do is we know that of these delta functions, all but one of them does an integral. And the one that doesn't do an integral is the one that remains. It says that the total external momentum is conserved. So we know that this whole thing is going to be proportional to an overall factor of I 2 pi to the fourth times delta to the four of Q1 QE. So that'll come from one of these delta functions. And everybody else does an integral. So the total number of integrals that will be left will be integral d4p over 2 pi. You know, every 2 pi to the fourth for an integral that's done takes out a 2 pi to the fourth that comes with the delta function. So in the end of the day, we're going to be left with, we had 1 for every internal line, and we subtract 1 for every vertex, sum over k and d. But then we have to add 1 back, we subtracted too many, so we should add 1 back because one of the delta functions actually is this one that's up front here. And then all the rest of the stuff goes along for the ride. So let me just, so this is this product over K and D. So we've got F to the fourth, P to the D over M to the D, V to the K, the number of vertices. And we have, for each propagator, we had a minus I, M squared, V squared over F to the fourth, divided by P squared plus mu squared. And I've got everything, right? So there's two things. It's much better to have the answer in terms of E, the number of external lines, because that's specific to the observable we're talking about. And it's less useful to have it as a function of these Vs and these I's. So I'm going to try and get rid of the I dependence. And there's two identities that are useful for that purpose. So we're going to simplify using two useful identities. One of them is called conservation of ends. So what that means is that I've got two ways of thinking of ends of lines. A line ends, so if I want to count the ends of a line, it will either come, I can either think of it as being the sum of all the prongs on a vertex. That's one way of counting all the ends of a line. That's that's a way a line could end. Or I could independently count it as being, I get 1 for every external line, and I have 2 for every internal line. And they have to give me the same answer, right? So that says that I have two ends to every internal line, and 1 end for every external line. And that should be the sum over all vertices, n and d, or k and d, of v times the number of vertices for the number of guys that end at that line, at that vertex. So that's something which relates to the v's and the e's and the i's. So I can use that to get rid of I if I like. And there's another identity, which is the definition of the number of loops. Did I get something wrong here?
Aren't there four? Don't you have?
So this is the total number of ends of lines. Well, I'll have 1 for each of these and 1 for each of these. And this is summing the number of ends that end as any of your vertex.
Yeah.
Definition of number of loops. So you might say, why do I have to define it? If I draw a picture, then you know how many loops there are in the picture. And that's true for graphs that I can draw on a plane. That's true. You know exactly what it means to have a number of loops. So let's define, first of all, let's define the number of loops in such a way that it agrees with what you pictorially think a loop is. But we'll do that for graphs that you can define on a plane. So so that relies on a topological identity that the Euler number of a surface, if I take some sort of a thing where I have a bunch of some sort of a lattice of things, it has some number of edges, has a number of vertices and a number of faces. That'll always, it doesn't have to be on a plane. If you give me a whole bunch of, you give me any shape I can, any surface, I can triangulate it in some way. And that's that that shape has there's a topological invariant, which is the, if I remember it says right, it's the number of faces minus the number of vertices plus the number of edges. So let's define, what we would have meant by a loop in a picture like this is the number of faces. So let's call that L. So L minus the number of edges, which would be in this case number of internal lines, plus the number of vertices, which is sum over K and D of V and K and D. That's what we would have meant by the Euler number of something. And if we take something that's on a plane, so if we take something like a circle, here's an example like that. I've got 1, 2, 3 edges, I've got 2 faces, and I've got 2 vertices. So in that particular case, L is equal to 2 minus 3 plus 2. This is equal to 1 for a planar graph. So I claim that for any graph I draw, this is the topological invariant. This is the Euler number. Any graph I draw on a plane, so here's another one, this combination is going to sum to 1. So let's just check it. So here we have, so in this particular case, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 faces. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 edges along the side. Then we have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So we have 12 internal lines. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 vertices. So if I plug that in, I have 5 minus 12 plus 8 is 13 minus 12 is 1. So the claim is you take any planar graph like that and you're going to get 1. But supposing it's not a planar graph, supposing we take the surface of a sphere. So we take something like, you're supposed to think of, maybe a better way to think of that is to take a tetrahedron, which is like a sphere which has been triangulated. So we'd have a tetrahedron to be something like this. In that case, we'd have 1, 2, 3, 4 faces. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 edges. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4 vertices. So in that case, chi would be 4 minus 6 plus 4, and that's minus 2. Minus 2.